Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Trails Management Subcommittee of May 21st, 2025. So for those who's first time joining the Trails Management Subcommittee, today we'll talk about the Trails Management Plan from the Chelan Multiple Species Habitat Conservation Plan, which discusses management of trails, habitat use within the Santa Rosa Peninsula National Monument Conservation Area. And we have different representatives here who make up the cities, different trail user groups, and our wildlife agencies. So we try to bring together as many of our interested parties as we can to discuss some of these important issues. So what we'll do to start the meeting off is we'll start by introducing ourselves. Those who have organization plates in front of you make up the Trails Management Subcommittee roster. So those are the only ones who we will ask to introduce themselves. We don't have any members joining virtually today, so we will just be introducing those who are here in person. I'll start on my far right with Susan.
Susan, about Desert Riders.
Good afternoon. I'm Sean Muir, the Community Services Manager for the City of Palm Desert.
Rick Benharis, City of Palm Springs, and also representing Palm Springs Search and Rescue.
Annie Ortiz with the Bureau of Land Management and Monument Manager for the Santa Rosa and San Jacinto Mountains National Monument.
Dee Carlin representing La Quinta.
Tony Quiroz representing Coachella Valley Conservation Commission.
Lori Salazar, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Stefan Allender with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife for Land South Program.
Ray Schneider representing Oswit Land Trust.
Doug Evans, Desert Riders and Desert Trails Coalition.
Richard Wood, a hiker.
And for anybody who wants an agenda or the roster, they're over there behind Kevin, who's manning our IT. So please feel free to help yourselves. And then just some housekeeping rules or ins and outs. The bathrooms are over there in the by the escalator or elevator, and the code is up on the whiteboard. So to start, let me share my screen. All right, perfect. So we went through introductions. A couple of announcements. At the last CVCC meeting, the Coachella Valley Conservation Commission motioned to approve the representatives from Oswit Land Trust, Ray Schneider, and Scott Collins from Oswit Land Trust to be alternate or primary and alternate on the Trails Management Subcommittee. So welcome to both of you. I know, Scott, you've joined us a couple of times before, but not
officially having us.
Yeah, of course. Your input is greatly appreciated, and we love having you guys contribute to this meeting. Next, I want to share some exciting news. The current location, the building that we're in, the building that we have continued to have these meetings in for a very long time, will be demolished here soon, and this will be the location of the new Palm Desert Library. So in the interim, we are going to be working out a temporary meeting location at the State Water Resource Control Board, which is across the parking lot here. So you'll still be able to park in the same place, more or less, but we'll be meeting over there until we have a long-term meeting location identified. We do go dark over the summer for this Trails Management Subcommittee, so we technically only meet once every other month between 1:30 and 3:30. But we do skip the summer months just because so many people are out of town and on vacation, things like that. So our next meeting won't happen until September, and it will be a new location. So just be mindful of that when you see the agenda. Next, we have member agency reports. This is just an open item for any members here who wanted to share any updates to the group. I think, from my standpoint, I wanted to share that unfortunately we did have a hiker pass away at the Rimrock Trail, which is owned, the starting point is owned by CVCC. It does go into BLM land, but we did have unfortunately a passing over the weekend. It's definitely something that we, you know, take seriously and are trying to do our best to avoid situations like that happening in the future. I think everything that we do here is to benefit, you know, humans and wildlife, and making sure that people can enjoy themselves in a safe and safe, healthy way is important. And so I think just trying to think about what we can do to, increase people's safety out on trails is always, important. But on that, does anybody else have any kind of announcements or updates they want to share with the rest of the group?
Tony, question, what seems to have occurred?
I don't know, but I do know that a gentleman went hiking on the Murray Peak Trail, trying to go to Murray Peak, and he got lost, or he didn't come back, right? So they went looking for him, and then they found him, deceased.
I was actually on the call.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a local person. Goes on this trail once, twice, three times a week. Very, very, very knowledgeable about the trails, went behind Bonds Rim Rock, hiked up to the top, dropped down into what we call 12 Palms, which is a big ravine, a cluster of palm trees. There's a drop-off waterfall. Goes down into that, follows that out to the what they call the old barracks. It was spillway that ends up over in Cat City. Does this hike quite a bit. Very fit guy. I actually found him, and it's up to the ME to figure out what happened. But when we found him, he was in a very restful state. So he was just lying down. So we actually had to hike him out. This was Tuesday morning. So we don't know. We don't usually know. It's usually an ME's report at some point. But we have actually been deployed over the last month. Four, five times in those canyons last month. So it's a lot. We're very busy, very active back here. So.
Do you know, from your perspective, is there anything that would help prevent some of these situations from happening in the future?
It's like 30% of these are bike accidents that we respond to. The others, they're lost, or it's straight up dehydration.
Okay.
Is most of the time, the level of dehydration is, for some of you who are used to that kind of thing, you know what that is. You get to that level of dehydration, you're not even thinking straight. You're not making sound decisions. You're not even on the same planet, personally. Some of the falls that these people take are completely preventable, and the only way that they would do that is because they were so dehydrated and they were just delusional, not knowing where they're at. So, and it's not just behind Bobby or Rocky, it's everywhere that we respond to.
Yeah, we're seeing stuff out of Indio Hills Badlands, evacuations from there.
Yeah.
Do you think there might be room for a seasonal? I mean, we don't want to get signed blindness where we put up too many notices, especially when they're not applicable during other times of the year. But possibly some signage at the trailhead saying, no water up ahead, temperatures have changed, anything like that? Or do you think that's just knowledge that...
It wouldn't be a bad idea, but then you get into sign pollution and does anybody actually read the signs, right? I mean, you can try to be preventable. We are a reaction unit, right? Mm-hmm. We're not a proaction unit, right? We're working more towards being a pre-action unit.
Yeah.
For all intents and purposes. But with these things in everybody's pocket, I've been Tucson, Arizona, see all their trails. Every single trailhead has a little QRL code or URL code name. And it gives them everything that they need to know. They download the trail. If I'm lost, here's who I call. It tells them everything. I mean, everybody's got their faces buried in these things all the time. So in my opinion, that's probably something that's a very cheap, easy thing to do, and you don't create a bunch of sign pollution. There it is, right? And honestly, we can't make people's decisions for them. We've got signs going to the Skyline Trail that says we're closed for the season, don't go past this point. And every week we get a call that somebody's past that point and they're in trouble. I can't stop that. Nobody can stop that. I've been on the unit 17 years, and I don't know that there's anything that we can do. A year and a half ago, we had a member that used to be a member's father started our unit, who passed away just above the museum.
Yeah.
Who knows why, you know? I don't know that there's an answer to it. You know, they're just bad decisions. You know?
I appreciate you sharing about this particular.
Yeah, I can't give any more information.
Yeah, it's,
you get the idea.
It's a good window into sort of some of the issues that we want to address in this group. So.
Yeah.
All right. Does anybody else have anything they'd like to share with the group at this point?
I'll share some good news. We actually had a donation come into the monument, about $7,000 from a nonprofit that is helping to support funding some of our recreation program for the federal lands. So we'll be looking at buying some new tools, some new signage stickers and stuff. And I know some of the new stuff we want to put at Trailheads is going to be on pause for a bit. We did lose our sign shop coordinator with the BLM. So that does put a little bit of a hiccup in some of our plans. We used to use those funds, but we will be using those greatly with needs that we have across the monuments landscape.
Okay,
cool.
On that note, Danny, when you guys decide to go through with your sign design, if you could share that with us, that'd be great, because Will, who is leading our Conservation Ranger program, he's getting closer and closer to developing an ordinance with Desert Recreation District, and that ordinance number would go on these signs, and that's what the rangers can enforce against. So that could be things like seasonal closures, no dogs on trails, and things like that. We talked a little bit last time about having cohesive signage in the same kind of style, working with amongst different agencies, I think is going to be important to make sure that those signs look somewhat uniform.
Yeah, I can share. We have BLM design standards for our national conservation lands like the monument, and we can add partner logos to that, but it's already preset with kind of detail, so it looks consistent across the boundaries. Like you go into the Park Service, you recognize right away consistency with logos. So I'm happy to share all that with you.
And yeah.
Yeah, I'll get you that probably by tomorrow.
Okay. Yeah, they can be consistent, but not, you know, exact replicas of each other, right? But at least kind of some similar styles.
Quick question.
Yeah.
Danny, when somebody makes a private donation to the BLM, how do you receive the money? Do you have I know that Joshua Tree has Friends of Joshua Tree that you route money through so that the Park Service doesn't end up having it disappear?
Right. So this one, the donation came from America's Foundation for America's Public Lands, and they selected two BLM locations in California to put donations to for specific needs. And so half the donation went to the monument for recreation and resources. So I'll pull the funds and be doing that. But that donation came through that group, and it called with what specifically it wanted to go towards.
That doesn't go into your general budget where it could get reappropriated?
Nope. So with that donation, it's dedicated to that specific request. So I know with Foundation for America's Public Lands is one group that we have that. And we also have through recreation.gov. There's a link on there for donating directly to the monument as well. So we're working on getting some of those informations out for people that do want to support specific targeted areas like that.
That when you mention ordinance, is that through the CVCC or is it through the different cities? Or
it would actually be through the Desert Recreation District is what our coordinator has found is the best path to being able to cite against. So they're the ones who have the authority to have an ordinance essentially that would encompass what we need, and any city that already contracts with Desert Recreation District, that includes, I think, Palm Desert, La Quinta, a few different others, would already kind of be included in this, but future agencies that want to contract with Desert Recreation District could also do that. So it's an easier way to try and get one ordinance applicable to multiple different land types. That's as much as I know about it, but Will, who is not available right now, would be able to share a little bit more information about that.
When will it be available?
The ordinance?
No, Will.
Oh, Will. He will be back, I think, at the start of next week.
Okay.
Something like that. Yeah. He's just out for a couple of weeks. So yeah, that would be the DRD ordinance. So they would technically be Desert Recreation District employees, would be the rangers. But CBCC would be funding most, if not all of it, for right now. Okay, so next, just to provide a little bit of context, the Trails Management Subcommittee was created because we have lots and lots of trails that exist within Peninsular Bighorn Sheep Habitat, which is a federally listed endangered species. And the CBCC has the ability to, we have a permit to quote unquote take their habitat by having trails within these areas. And that trail use and trail activities really needs to be in balance with Peninsular Bighorn Sheep and their recovery. They're, we were talking a little bit about how they're currently doing. And Chris today is our wildlife biologist for CDFW, and he is here to share a little bit more about what he's finding out in the field. So thanks for joining us, Chris.
No problem. Yeah, I'm Chris. I'm the Peninsular Bighorn Sheep biologist for CDFW, currently working up in our region 6, also covering down south into Borrego to the border too. So this might be a little bit out of the scope of just these northern recovery regions, but you guys get the full show. This is what happened at the sheep summit we just had. So here's a visual aid. If you guys haven't seen a bighorn sheep, I'm pretty sure everybody here has. Mm-hmm. That's what they look like. So this presentation, we all go over captures. There's disease that goes in here, population estimate, issues of concern. We'll just the issues that don't pertain to the Coachella Valley, I'm just going to blast right through them, but you can see them if you want. I'm happy to answer any questions about that. So captures, this last fall, we caught 86 bighorn, 53 ewes, 33 rams, added 80 to our 80 new individuals to our marked population here. We did have 2 deaths that were reported immediately. It kind of breaks down into this. So for the top 3, we caught 25 in recovery regions 1 through 3, so San Jacinto through La Quinta. For connectivity, like, they do go all over. These are some of the new callers. This is down by the border, down south, and this is over by Enza Borrego, Borrego Springs. You can see there the top left-ish. But anyways, they go all over the mountains. They have quite a bit of connectivity down south too, going from the Vallecito Mountains up to the San Ysidro Mountains. Getting up back up north, this is recovery region 4 and a little bit of 3 up here. They kind of move around a little bit. But then when you get up to the northern regions here, you can definitely see that San Jacinto and the North Santa Rosa Mountains, there's a lot of connectivity around Indian Canyon there. They do go back and forth quite a bit. That might be due to lambing. That's something we're going to figure out. And you definitely have a pocket that pretty much only exists in La Quinta by the golf courses. Okay, disease. Out of those marked individuals, we did come up with these results. We took blood samples from all of the sheep, sent them off to our labs. And yeah, there are a couple active infections. Pretty much every one of them was exposed at some point in their life to Mycoplasma ovum pneumoniae. But yeah, up in the recovery regions 1 through 3, there is a high prevalence of disease and active disease too. So the MOVI strains that we do get, it's the peninsular strain, and this is a tool that's being developed by our wildlife health lab, just doing some disease mapping here. This is just a snippet of that, where you can see that the peninsular strain of MOVI is very much present. And you also get this Joshua tree strain that's coming from the north, and we're uncertain about how that is connected there. So that would be disease from Joshua tree somehow making it across the Coachella Valley to San Jacinto and La Quinta areas. We had a film crew that was curious to come out with us, so that'll be coming out this summer, I think. I don't know if you want to go see it, that's fine. They were also working on these drinkers that were down in Recovery Regions 8. So back to the population estimates. So after we captured, we flew, we had 11 days of flights. We saw 512 individuals. That breaks down like this for a range-wide estimate here, range-wide overview. So out of the 161 marks, we did see 92 of them. So it's a pretty good rate of 57%. That factors into our math to do some population estimates. So here's what it looks like from the helicopter. Why it's only 57% and not higher is because, you know, you get some well-behaved sheep and you have some not cooperative sheep where these groups will run about. It's hard to difficult to see the collars, etc. We do take this big old giant fancy camera to get unique IDs for later. Okay, this is a breakdown here. So in San Jacinto through the northern and central Santa Rosa Mountains, we have a lot of PBS, basically from Recovery Region 1 through 3, and then 6 through 9, those are pretty much split evenly. One of the interesting things is that the San Jacinto, we didn't see any lambs whatsoever during our flights. And presumably that's because that we saw them all in the northern Santa Rosa Mountains. And that could be just be because of connectivity. So individuals that are living near Palm Springs might end up going down to, you know, Cathedral City or, you know, as far south as Rancho Mirage, I guess, presumably, to lamb and then come on back with them. It's possible that there is some lambs in the San Jacinto region that we just didn't catch at the time. So this is a typical group here. 4 is about the average that we did see. Got 1 class 2 ram, 1 class 3 ram, a yearling ewe, and a collared ewe. Okay, so from the last 4 CDFW abundance surveys, this is the composition trends that are happening. Everything is pretty much quote-unquote normal. It's just everything's even. There's not a whole lot of changes between the years with that as far as composition. So to me, I'm seeing that normal recruitment, normal fecundity, and normal sex ratios. Here's another big old group. Hard to spot everybody there. It's 13. Okay, so this is what it is. So this is what it looks like as the abundance. So we did mark resite here. We did Chapman estimator. And so for recovery regions 1 through 3, you can see that there's a ton in La Quinta. And that shouldn't be a surprise. Everybody pretty much knows that there's issues with PGA West and Tradition down there having a lot of sheep at them. That's an ongoing mitigation project. We've had some success there. I'll go later into the other populations. So, but yeah, you can see in Enzo Borrego, basically, there's not a whole lot of sheep until you get down, way down towards Mexico or nearby Mexico there in Carrizo Canyon. Some ewes hanging out. The ewes follow basically the same trend. In population biology, it's important to go check out what the ewes are, or what females are doing, because they reproduce. They're way more important there in this biology. We do have an issue with not everything is a closed population. As you can see in the south, in the south San Isidro Mountains and the Vallecito Mountains, there is some, like, there's no error bar for the Vallecito Mountains. It's because the U groups are right on the border of where the recovery units were established. And as you can see here, this is where we've spotted them. Yeah, right along Highway 78. So right in the middle, if you got the South San Ysidro Mountains, and it's in the center, it's the South San Ysidro Mountains, and in the south, that's the Vallecito Mountains there. And there's quite a bit of overlap that is known with this. So if you can look really closely at that map, where it says Vallecito, Lizard Wash, and South San Ysidro, they all overlap there. So you get quite a bit of movement there, and that's also seen with the movement data that we have on GPS. Up north, it's more straightforward until you get down to recover into the La Quinta region and south toward the Salton Sea there. Then there's some more U-groups that occupy that land. And then the lands south of La Quinta in the recovery units just become a whole lot bigger. It's kind of a density issue here. So, but this is the trend that we've seen with PBS over the last four aerial surveys that CDFW has conducted. And so this is an N of four. So take the p-value here with a grain of salt. We're not hypothesis testing, we're trend identifying. So this is a linear regression about what's happened. The high point actually was in 2010. We'll go back to even farther with abundance surveys here in just a second. But basically it's kind of to show that, yes, for the abundance surveys, they have been increasing, but ever since 2010, they've been on decline, at least as far as range-wide. I don't have a exact reason why that is, but this is what's happening at the moment. There's a happy little ram in San Jacinto. So you can take that and look at it per recovery unit here. The biggest thing I just want to say here was there was a dramatic decrease in the Vallecito Mountains, so nowhere near us. We're going to try and figure that out. But that is something that was the biggest change since the 2022 population estimate. And what that breaks down to is it looks like this. Let's just focus on the top three, which are around us. So San Jacinto, it seems like there is a increase there. And we've definitely been noticing that there have been many more incursions into Palm Springs. In right around Cathedral City in the northern Santa Rosa Mountains, there really isn't very much change. We've got some high error bars with the linear regression, but that seems pretty steady. There is some overlap between recovery units one and two. And then over in the traditions La Quinta area, I thought it would have been a higher, a steady increase, but it is a little bit more even than what's happening in the Palm Springs area. And why that might be is, you know, if you were to pick a habitat to live in, would you rather be in this really spiky area over here to the left, or would you be munching on a golf course to the right? And obviously, you can see the preference right there. That's just something that they want to be at. So where there are the most PBS, it's up north. And particularly when you looked at recovery units one and three, where there are available golf courses to go to, that seems to be where they want to spend their time. And, you know, when you give a whole bunch of resources to these sheep, they want to, they feel a little bit easier appropriating there. And then you just have these huge areas down south where they are refuges. But there's so much land out there, you can have a lot of sheep. And indeed, this is the density plotted here. So there's really concentrated resources, particularly near La Quinta, and then there's just isn't a whole lot of resources down in the Vallecito Mountains and Carrizo Canyon. So yeah, so there's a moderate negative trend range wide. For the Vallecito Mountains, that was the biggest change since the last population survey. And they don't quite yet meet the recovery goal criteria. That's something that we need some more time to see what's happening here. Okay, so we can speed on through this. They do cross the border quite a bit. Where there's no border wall, they regularly go down to Mexico and come back up north for seasonal water and resources. So we're working with OSU right now to try and see what we can do to keep that at least permeable for Peninsula Bighorn Sheep. Down at Interstate 8, I don't know if you guys drive there often, but there's a lot of border there's a lot of road strikes there. And so the Interstate 8 wildlife crossing is continuing to go forward. We're trying to get a basically a wildlife bridge down there because they get hit quite often. But the human wildlife conflict is probably what pertains most to us up here in the Coachella Valley. As you can see, like they really get habituated to people. They just like being on the green for sure. And they'll go right up close to areas that are high danger for them. We often see them drown in the canal, occasionally in people's pools. It's pretty scary. You don't want them to go and slip in the water. Right along here. So alongside CVCC, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and other agencies here, the fence that has gone over, the La Quinta fence line has been successful in conjunction with a one-way wildlife gate. There are some dangers here, and they can come through these little tiny cracks that happen in this fence. It is not the best placement for it, but it is what we got at the moment. There are still drownings right now. It's something that is ongoing, and until the sheep are basically on the wild side, all of them on the wild side, there's going to continue to be some drownings and some incidents with the people. But the one-way wildlife gate has been a success. We've seen at least 6 exits. There's only been one incursion that was fixed, actually within hours. Coincidentally, I was there that same day. We've had agency members and volunteers show up, and we've been able to effectively lure more than 30 individuals out of PGA West. I actually had some residents recently just asking if we've declared victory over the sheep. We have not. There are still some on the property, but as far as returning sheep to the wild, so far, I have to thank everybody who's participated in this at CVCC with the whole fence line. It has worked so far. It is something that I think future fences can be very effective in managing PBS here. Here is an example of a ewe leaving. She goes through this gate. Essentially, this is a top-down view of the gate. You see the fence in black, the gate in blue, and the path of the PBS in the gray there. They'll follow a trail of bait out to this bait site. They'll walk through it. The tines, they're on a spring, so they'll go through it, and they won't be able to go back. And indeed, you see this really cute little lamb going through. And mom comes on by right there. There's a confident ewe walking through here. Here's a very not confident ewe walking through there, just jumping through. And on the wild side, since there is a large population that is going from a very subsidized area to a very not subsidized area, what we've done is to mitigate that, we put a temporary drinker out there, and we're trying to replace this with a permanent drinker, which hopefully should be installed later this year. In Palm Springs, we do know about all of the headlines of sheep coming down into the, from the mountains, getting into roadways and causing a ruckus there. It's something that we're looking into to try and mitigate and prevent here. courtesy of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service tracking this. There are a number of incidents here. The bigger the circles on here, the more frequent there have been incidents. And it's something that will help guide us in trying to figure out what to do very soon, actually. And with that, here's some PBS at PGA. Thanks.
Thanks, Chris. So I'll open it up to people who have questions, and then we do have some attendees on Zoom as well. So if you can just raise your hand, and then Kevin will just let me know if we have any questions there. But I do see that Rich Wood here has a question. A
couple of questions. The GPS callers, do they connect to the regular cell phone company? You have a contract with one of those providers so that it periodically sends data just like a cell phone would to a cell phone tower?
It's more like a satellite phone, so it goes through. Okay,
it's directly all satellite then.
Yeah.
And the positioning is by a GPS device in the collar, so you got location to within 20 feet or less of a loop.
It really depends on where the sheep is. Like if it's in the canyon, we're going to get like a lot less accuracy because it has to reach the satellites.
And it's time stamped as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. But you know they. We typically take a GPS point every 2 to 4 hours, and it'll transmit about every 6 points. So every, say, like day to every other day or something, we're getting points in from the sheep if everything's going normal.
Okay, the reason I'm asking is Dr. Longshore is working on a project to try to associate trail use to sheep behavior, and the source that was used are the trail counters you see out here. I don't even know how accurate the clocks are. They can't tell what direction trip caused count in the trail counter. Cocker goes either way, it's going to trip. And they don't really know when it trips, if a bighorn is a mile away, whether that trip could be associated with the movement or not. My suggestion was that they contact the cell phone companies and get anonymized data for cell phone ping locations from the cell towers. That way they would know anonymized where a cell phone was. And if you combine that with the data from the collars, you could then overlay the two and you'd see something much more accurately than you would from a trail counter.
Yeah, I mean, that would be really cool to get that data off people for sure. As far as the data from the sheep, we could probably do that with some of the collars, but like we have to balance that with the battery life.
Okay, so that's the first question. The second is looking at PGA West. You know, I have video, you've got plenty of them. And the animals, this was taken 11 years ago, they're thriving there. There was a lot of young animals. And you recognize how well they do on a golf course, apparently. I think in some instances, it's not a fair shot to say that they want some of them get sick and some of them drown in the canal. If you have a city with 1 million people, you're going to have more deaths than you will in a city with 30 people. And because there's so many animals there, a lot of them are being produced. The overall effect is a higher population, which you've shown there. So I believe that it's not really a fair shot to say, well, one drowned in the canal. So, you know, they could die someplace else. They wouldn't even be registered if they were in the backcountry.
I counter that with these are animals that like they have evolved to never be around any kind of big old giant standing water source like that. Maybe you can get some analogy with like a Tanaha that is just like a big cauldron shape that, you know, they could fall in there. But like, you know, that canal source there, like the way it's built right now, it's, you know, they can try and struggle to get out of it, but every single one that's like,
how many meaningful losses has there been in the last 10 years? Like, I mean, not an old ram that's beyond its time of being affected, but young breedable animals are a real cost to the herd. How many have there been approximately?
I don't know if I can give you an approximate right now. I'm still going through and modernizing some of our data sets from previous biologists who have had this position. But I could tell you it's not zero for sure. Most animals that I've seen that I've, you know, gone through the database and whatnot are like lambs and ewes, right? And if you want to look at population biology there, those are the ones that count the most. The rams, they'll go on by and, you know, you could get a ram, one ram that could do pretty well with the harem sheep, but
so looking at the effect, is the fence now 9 miles long?
I don't know the length of it.
Sorry, we have a couple hands raised as well. If you have another question, okay. So Elizabeth, I see we have I see we have your hand raised, and then Amy.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep.
Thank you for the presentation, Chris. This was super helpful. This is Elizabeth King from Coachella Valley Mountains Conservancy. I have a couple of questions, but I would like to start with, when will this data be publicly released, and will there be some sort of public outreach or rollout of this data?
I don't know. It's whenever I can get this thing done. So we're putting together a memo to send off like internally, and that'll be pretty much expedited to, I think, to be public. I can't tell you exactly. It's whenever I'm not swamped with work.
Yeah, I totally understand. I'm just thinking, when we get questions, if we could ballpark, like, are you thinking 2025, 2026?
No, this should be available this year. This is sometime this year. I want to like just be done with it. We gotta move on.
Okay. And you mentioned the exposure versus active infection data. I'm wondering about the impacts to the sheep. Could you explain a little bit about the impacts of an active infection in sheep versus exposure?
Well, okay. So presumably you've gotten sick in your life, right? And you've recovered?
Yes, no, I understand the difference, but what I'm asking is, if you have a sheep that has an active infection of pneumonia, do they typically die? Do they get sick for a year? Like, what kind of impacts do we see?
I am not exactly sure their survival after it, or like during it. It's something that some do survive, some don't. That's something that we're trying to answer with our mortality data. So as soon as one of our collared sheep dies, it's really important to know why. And so, you know, that's something I'll have to go out and investigate as quickly as I can. We do send these samples to a lab to try and get tested, try and figure out that. So I would need to go and do some more digging into our data to see what we have in terms of mortality data here.
Okay. Do they do an inoculation program ever? Or are there any sorts of vaccines?
I think there are some vaccines for livestock, but I haven't heard of a successful one in wild sheep yet. That's something I can look into.
Okay. Okay. And just wanted to also thank you for the pictures of the one-way gate. It looks like it's being well monitored, and I'm happy to see that that's working. So those are my comments. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Amy?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. Chris, great job on your presentation. Thank you. Just a couple of notes to just help fill in a couple gaps. So there were lambs in the St. Jacinto's, but they were just hiding on you. But that said, there was only four that we know of that survived. So that's tough to see on your surveys there. And they were in the St. Jacinto's, like at the end of the year and routinely and stuff. We were seeing them routinely in there, so they're just hiding. To Richard's comments, maybe poo-pooing the canal or whatever. We just had a lamb in the canal this past weekend. A golfer jumped in and saved it, thankfully. So it's a real danger, and they don't belong there, and these are preventable deaths. And we've documented 68 known sheep deaths since 2012, when the fence was talked about starting. And so these are all preventable deaths, and that's a big effect on the population. And to Elizabeth's comments with the pneumonia, you know, when you have a active infections and so forth, you're not going to have good lamb survival. When you have adults that are sick, they can survive it usually, but you're going to see poor lamb survival. And we've had very poor lamb survival in the San Jacinto Mountains, like in the last 8 years. So like Chris mentioned, there's some active infection over there, and that's likely what's resulting with the low lamb survival over there. And we did try a vaccine years ago with our captive herd, and it was unsuccessful. We did not see any difference in their immunity. So Chris was correct. There are some livestock vaccines that they're trying to get you know, domestic farmers to vaccinate their animals in case they come in contact with the wild sheep. But thus far, there has not been a successful vaccine because, you know, you're dealing a lot with viruses, which we know, you know, mutate and so forth. So that's it.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions here from the group in person? Doug?
Yeah, the disease that you're seeing in the western area, what's the origin of that?
The western, so Mycoplasma ovipositor, I think there's a natural strain, but basically we don't know how the Joshua tree strain of MOV is getting to the peninsula. That's our, is that what you're asking there? That's something that like domestic sheep can transmit this thing too. So, you know, if there's any instance of some person dumping off a sheep that they don't want into the desert and it finds its way to a population, which can happen, you know, that could be a potential source of disease and not just MOV, but that's one of the bigger diseases with them.
So you're actually seeing a disease strain that's primarily in Joshua tree over here.
Yeah, it's kind of mixed. Yeah, and we don't know the mechanism of how that got over here at all. We don't see the peninsular strain coming over there at all, which would indicate that there's, you know, some sort of interchange. But we do see that the Joshua tree strain of MOVI is in recovery regions 1 and 3. So how that got there, maybe somebody had a domestic sheep with that and was able to they brought it to the peninsulars. We're not sure. You know, it's possible that it's possible it could have come from something that we just don't know about. So it's just an interesting question at the moment. It's something that we just need to track to see if that is going to spread any farther south or not.
Chris, are you seeing the PGA West herd have a higher infection rate than maybe some of these more sparse herbs? I can't remember it.
Let's go back to the slide. I'll click there. I'll open it. Just that one. Right. Blah, blah, blah. I would say it seems pretty even. It seems like San Jacinto has got a lot of disease up there. I mean, it's pressed up against people quite a bit. But I would need to study a little bit further. And I would think that we probably need a little bit more samples too for, you know, if it's like truly higher at La Quinta versus everywhere else. But, you know, that's where we are seeing a lot of active infections too, is where, you know, you have bigger groups, there's a higher potential for them just to spread it all around, as opposed to these like really like low densities down in Carrizo Canyon or you know, Vallecito Mountains.
And then I know Rick did raise his hand.
Yeah, just a couple quick ones. Can these strains be transferred by other domestic animals, like horses or dogs or anything like that?
I think so. Let me get back to you on that. Coming at it as a, I'm not a disease expert, but I'll find that out. I'm pretty sure.
The reason I ask is because you got a lot of horse groups.
Yeah.
Doug can tell you this too. They'll load up their horses in, say, the high desert, bring them down here. They'll go riding for the weekend and go back to the high desert.
Yeah.
Or could it be spread like, you know, you got parvo, and so you got it on your shoe. So then if you go to another kennel, now it's in another kennel. You know, I mean, they're very basic questions in nature. I don't expect you to
answer. Yeah.
Is that something that is a potential?
I think it's something that we should definitely look into a lot with that. I'm going to consult with our wildlife health lab to see what kind of vectors MOB can spread through. But I would think that would be a likely thing, is like some other kind of domestic animal is possible spreader, but I don't know. I'm going to get back to you on it.
Annie?
It's just kind of with Rick's idea. I know a couple of months ago, a while back, there was on the news somebody hiking with their pet pig, and just wondering if that could have been another potential vector.
There's all sorts of weird things. Like, you know, something too, this happened about a year ago in Zaborrego, was like, you know, a domestic sheep got loose and was in the middle of the desert. No clue where it came from. But, you know, that's just one instance. There, we occasionally get reports of people that will just like, okay, well, somebody will have a sheep and then just dump it someplace because they can't take care of it. Maybe it was a hobby animal and they have to move or something like that. There's all sorts of weird stories, and there's millions and millions of people in, you know, Southern California. So some weird oddball thing that just like brings one, that brings disease over through one instance, it can proliferate through that. So it's something that like, we might not even know how it got there at all or ever, but it's there.
We have time for one or two more questions.
Chris, I'm just looking at the figure like you did. It appears one of one sheep was tested. It's 100%.
Yeah, so that's kind of why I'm saying I think we need some more data on this to actually see.
I mean, it's not even a statistical sample.
Yeah, this is the data that we have. So
you made the comment that the incidence seems to be higher in Quito.
We can probably go back, but in recovery regions 1 through 3, it is higher. Yeah.
That's 4.
It's also 3 there. If you're looking at LA, UA, GU.
See, Elizabeth, do you have your hand raised again?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
One final question. With the decline in population since 2010, that was also when the captive breeding releases started to decline as well, and I believe ceased completely in 2016. Does CDFW see any correlation or potential causation there?
This is data for the range wide. It's something that I'm going to have to go back and see what had happened there. I think one of the concerns with the captive breeding was it had to do with disease control. And it's something that if there were to be a captive breeding program, we would really have to we'd have to work with everybody to make sure that disease is not spreading outwards. And captive populations aren't being a source of that. And I'm sure that we can figure out a good way to do that, but we haven't been able to do it at the moment. So whether the cancellation of the captive breeding program and the decline of bighorn sheep is causal, I don't think we really can say, but you know, it did happen at the time. I'm pretty sure that the captive breeding program wasn't releasing sheep down into Anza-Borrego. You know, one of the big declines that we've seen recently, you know, in the last 2 years was the Vallecito Mountains. And that's something that we really want to like look out for, because there's a whole lot of land and habitat out there. And for them just to be naturally declining, it's kind of concerning.
All right, we have a question in person here. That'll be the last one here. I do see Amy and Tom, you guys raised your hands. Let's try to see if we can get all three answered, but that will have to be the last questions here. So, Rich?
Looking back, Martinka, what are you doing on the other side of the fence on the wilderness side? You showed, a drinker. Mm-hmm. Are you providing, you know, there's an awful lot of high quality vegetation on the golf course, and it's pretty parsed. Pretty much nothing on the other side. It's pretty dried out. So all those animals that end up on the wrong side of the fence or the right side of the fence, whatever opinion you have, what's going to happen? Do you anticipate that the numbers are going to go down, that the breeding is going to go down if they're completely eliminated from that golf course? And the other part two is, are they out there? You said there's still some in the golf course, are there still stragglers? Is there a significant number, or are they mostly all now eliminated from the golf course?
Most of them have been relocated to like the wild side. We're actively trying to, you know, continue that process there. And luckily with the one-way gate, like it's all probable that they can exit on their own. Every single golf course is artificially subsidizing these sheep. And so when you give a whole bunch of resources to the sheep, they can do really well. It's artificial. It's something that like, if you take away somebody's like, you know, access to an all you can eat buffet, like, you know, obviously they're going to eat less. They have to like pay for it themselves or something. So if we do see a like complete cutoff from all the golf courses, we might see a decline in sheep from the carrying capacity of the, you know, to meet the carrying capacity of the landscape. It's something that the golf courses weren't there when the sheep, you know, lived here for thousands of years. So, you know, we're going to see what we can do to try and return it to more of that state, have less human caused deaths.
Is your objective to take out the drinkers and any forage eventually and on the other side? Are you going to leave that there?
Yeah, we're going to leave it. You know, it's something that we're putting in a permanent drinker down there. Yeah. Part of the mitigation efforts for the recovery plan is to make their habitat a little bit better, I think. So putting in some of the water subsidies is in line with the recovery plan.
And they do have a temporary wildlife drinker there, and that will become permanent, just going through permits and stuff with the water district. I see Amy and then Tom, and that'll have to be the end of that. Go ahead, Amy.
Okay, so real quick, just to Elizabeth's comment about the captive herd. So we had very rigorous disease testing protocols that the state actually ended up following our panels years later. So everything we sent out was disease-free, et cetera. We don't believe there's a correlation in the decline due to us no longer releasing sheep. It's going to be more of a function of now they're in the urban areas and, you know, they're ingesting all these chemicals and so forth. We don't totally understand how that affects their immunity. We know some of the fertilizers can decrease their immunity. So it's not all great that they're eating in these urban areas. So that's, you know, one issue that's now more prevalent than ever before. When we were releasing sheep, like in the San Jacintos, they never even came down to the perimeter. People wouldn't see them when they hiked, et cetera. So things have changed over the years, for sure.
Thanks, Amy. And then Tom?
I'm wondering if there are any corollary studies being done in northern Mexico, if there are biologists of Mexico who you interact with or exchange data with?
Not super regularly. This is something that recently doing the
Border crossings, let's go down to that right now. Down over here, we do interact with some biologists down there, but this is going to be primarily through through OSCU's research. So it's something that we don't regularly talk to them directly. The peninsular sheep have a number of barriers in their home ranges, and down in Mexico, it would seem that in addition to, you know, some other board, like the border wall or something being some sort of barrier there, Highway 2 in Mexico seems to be pretty impenetrable for them. So you see our sheep that may even want to go farther south into Mexico, they'll just go along Highway 2 in it, and then they'll come back up to this group. This in particular is called the Yacumba group. They'll go back up into California for some water, and then go back down to Mexico for some water too.
All right. Well, thanks, Chris.
Just a quick comment.
Sure.
When the sheep were declining and we were having discussions with the agency biologist, the issue of supplemental water came up. It was absolutely hammered down as not being needed, not being successful. And yet, across the valley with the Nelson Bighorn, there's guzzlers all over.
Yeah.
So it's refreshing to hear that even though it's in response to a man-made obstacle, there's an acknowledgement that the sheep need help.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it was frustrating when all we're hearing about is sheep decline and everybody's saying, are we doing anything to help the habitat? And maybe some of the water moved up away from the golf courses, supplemental water. In the San Jacintos, there's quite a bit of water. Even in the Santa Rosas, there's less water. If you can move the sheep away from the edges before they demise because there's not enough water, you know, because of the fences and then the vegetation and being shifted from feeding on the golf courses to having to forage up in the hills.
Yeah.
Or it's pretty tough down there.
Yeah, it's certainly tough for these sheep everywhere. I think one of the concerns, at least I have in particular with them, and this might be backed up by some data, but it's kind of a sense of what's going on, is that the climate might be changing faster than the sheep can adapt. It's one of these things where I would take that as a personal thing and don't take it with any kind of data. It's something that our department is looking more and more into supplying water to them, because there seems to be less and less water sources available. So if they don't have any water sources at all, then they're certainly at risk of, you know, dehydration. They need some standing water, particularly in summer. And if you don't have it at all, then you could see some more rapid declines, I think. So I think that's something that we're seeing more and more with our department is being in support of putting in some more artificial water sources.
All right, well, thank you, Chris. You handled the firing squad well.
Sure.
It's always super important information that you bring to the table. So thanks for sharing with the group here. I know I learned a lot. All right, moving on to the next parts of the agenda. Trails Plan Working Group. We had a kickoff meeting. The Trails Plan is part of the CBMSHCP, or Pachelbel Multiple Species Habitat Conservation Plan, to address trail use in the habitat that is being shared with the Peninsula Bighorn Sheep. and how do we best go about that? The original 2008 plan was revised in 2014 by this group or this subcommittee here back then. And we're now looking at that trails plan and really trying to improve it and update it to be as helpful as possible with what we're all trying to achieve. In the group meeting last week, we talked about different challenges that we've identified with the trails plan. The most popular thing brought up was land ownership and jurisdictional issues. That can be very complicated out here in the Coachella Valley, and dealing with land types, land uses, private properties can make it challenging to manage it as one cohesive unit. We also talked about public confusion, public education, signage. You know, when you're being told you can do this here, but not here, and once you go past here, then it goes back to you can do it, and it just gets really difficult for a trail user who wants to do the right thing to do the right thing. And that kind of all is tied into land ownership and jurisdiction, right? We also talked about Peninsula Bighorn Sheep and the need for more research like Chris is doing, right? And we need to identify the different problems that are existing within the different habitat types. We talked about the lack of enforcement and then new technologies coming up, e-bikes, social media, telling people they can do something that they're not supposed to be able to do. And then again, going back to signage and whether it's effective or not, and if, are we having too much signage out there to the point where no one's reading anything? We also talked about different opportunities that exist now. GIS is a new is getting better and better each day, and city staff, county staff, and CVCC staff are all have dedicated GIS teams now that can help with some of this spatial data. There's also new phone applications for figuring out land ownership and right trail information. And then we have our ranger program that will help address a lot of this. And BLM has been doing their pop-up ranger outreach program at trailheads that will meet trail users where they are and give them accurate information direct from the source. So in talking a little bit about these different opportunities and collaborations, what we're going to do is have a follow-up meeting where we're going to use this working group to identify and break down parts of the trails plan and really start to bring it up to 2025 and consider some of these things that maybe weren't considered before, use some of these technologies that weren't used before. So we actually have Jim Foote here in public peanut gallery, but he was pretty influential in the original revision. So thanks, Jim, for all of what you've done to get us where we're at today. And but thankfully, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We just have to tweak it and update it. And I'm hoping that this endeavor will be fruitful for everybody and that we can really help trail management in the future. Does anybody else want to share any kind of insights about the working group? I just wanted to provide a group an overview here for this group here for those who weren't able to attend the meeting. Yeah, Rich?
Doug, yeah, same thing.
Oh, Doug.
Yeah, Doug, it would be helpful for the working group and eventually this group to get that track changes version of the plan because, you know, you just get the plan and say, this is the revised trails plan. You don't know where it came from.
Yeah, I included it in the folder.
Well, so, it was in the folder.
Yeah, so you'll be able to find it in the folder there. Okay. I'll maybe try to make the naming a little bit easier to navigate, okay. But you should find the copy that I've shared with you in that folder.
Okay.
I think Jim actually did that version where you have different annotations and what was changed from the original one. So, yep, that'll be for you.
Okay.
Rich?
Do you subscribe to a more sophisticated version of use Google Earth where you get more information, more overlays that's not available to someone that just logs in from the net web?
I can speak for CVCC. We have ArcGIS. We also use Google Earth, but not that much. ArcGIS really has most of our spatial data that lives in it. It's easier to manipulate it there than in Google Earth. We will use Google Earth for some things. The resolution can be a little bit better and sometimes, and the ability to time hop is really cool. But we also do have a subscription with Nearmap, which provides higher resolution, more up-to-date mapping, but it's really expensive. So that's something that we use, but it's not that readily available for most people, unfortunately. GIS can be pricey. For nonprofits, it's actually pretty affordable, but the learning curve to be able to use GIS is kind of steep. So it's one thing to get the application and get access to it. It's another thing to actually be able to use it for what it can really do.
As part of the work group, we did talk about the sharing of data with GIS. So like my GIS analyst at City Palm Springs, you know, we share data. Well, most cities do get their data from the county. Then you create your own layers on top of that. We share a lot of stuff with the tribe. The tribe's GIS system is
the best.
It's good. Yeah, I'm not trying to specify. It's inside the best, right? But everybody, all the different cities could have their GIS analysts talk with the, and you can all share data, right? So then Esri actually has these pre-made up platforms, which are a user portal, so to speak, so that it becomes really easy to use, so that if you were using the QR codes at the trailheads, people can download them, and if it goes through this Esri user face thing that they have, it actually becomes very easy to use because it gives you some select buttons to kind of pick, you know, it shows you ownership, shows you where the trail is, some emergency contact information. I don't know that as a outward user, like for a trail user, I don't think you want them be able to access 87 layers of a GIS system. It's not necessary.
Right.
So, but I think as part of this user group, that's something that you can define, because in 2014, when this was updated, GIS was still, you know,
yeah,
it was expensive and not everybody had an analyst. Now it's on my phone, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, so updating it with this kind of information is going to go a long way. It's going to help with the entire trails management system a lot. And then other agencies can really benefit from it. BLM, Fish and Game, Fish and Wildlife. They'll have their own GIS also, but they don't have my layers.
Right. Right?
They don't have her layers.
Right.
But if we share it all, it's a relatively easy thing amongst GIS analysts. I couldn't tell you what it is, but all the different things are, but those people can really help a lot.
Yeah, that's a great idea. We have our own GIS analyst, so I'm sure she'd be interested in working with the other agencies on something like that. I definitely think trying to reduce the number of questions. So when a trail user goes out, are they doing the right thing? Are they on the right trail? Are they using it the right way? All of that should be communicated to them instantly, right? If we can, or ahead of time before they even get to the trail. So cutting down on some of that confusion through the sharing of data and maps and accuracy is going to be really important. Jenny?
And for that, for BLM and Forest Service, we use a program called Avenza a lot, where we create the GIS shapefile with the layers, whatever, of trails or ownership. And so when you're on the map, you know, if you're out hiking, you see what part of the trail you're on. You can see the land ownership. You don't have to be a GIS expert. That's a great, simple way that I know we use a lot with doing that, even with our trail stewards. We're using that for monitoring with when we're on the trail, document stuff and pull information and see along whereabouts on the trail we are. So that can be another great way with chunking different map sections. I know that's something we're trying to definitely pull together here.
That's a good point, because like with cities, and this has nothing to do with trails, but like cities, if I'm buying for money from CBAG or from the state for pay, as a city, I have to put in my condition, pavement, index, ratings. And that rating has how many cracks the pavement has, all this kind of stuff. But when we first started that, each city had their own pavement index software. So you weren't comparing apples and apples, right? So if you went to CBAG, CBAG says, well, how do I know your street's only at 50 and that they say that theirs is at 20? They need more money. Well, not everybody was using the same software. Not everybody was using the same thing. If it becomes a more cohesive thing where everybody's using that same type of trail software that's really easy, then that information sharing, it becomes uniform. It doesn't matter what agency's using it. It becomes more uniform. You don't have different softwares that aren't able to connect or oh, I have to download a different software to get that trail halfway. Once I leave BLM land and I go to Palm Desert, I have to have a different software to read that same trail. Right. They should all be on the same, using the same type of platform. And part of the trails group is probably to identify that, something like that. Not yeah. identify which one, but we should all be using the same.
Yeah,
similar to.
That's a good point. I know like the bump and grind trip is. Correct if I'm wrong, Sean, I think it's managed by the city of Palm Desert, right? But once you get onto the trail, right, CBCC has land, BLM has land, but then the city is involved in a certain way, right? So making sure that we're all on the same page with the information that we want to communicate to the trail user mm-hmm. from the beginning. Okay. Well, yeah, we'll continue that effort, and I'll send a calendar invite when we have a selected day for the follow-up meeting. Just to reiterate, I did ask if people can comment on the plan, the 2014 plan by June 9th, and then we would like to meet before June 30th. So if you can just fill out the doodle poll if you haven't already, if you were part of that Trails Climb working group. But right now it's looking like we might be meeting either June 17th or June 18th, but fill out your availability and then we will get that squared away. Next, we have a couple of updates for the different working groups that we have. The enforcement of dog ordinances. I just wanted to share an update that I received from our former rep of Palm Desert, Donna Bean, who has now been replaced by Sean Muir here. She reached out to the city of Palm Desert to talk about different issues that have been shared here at this group at the Art Smith Trailhead with dog walkers in areas where they're not supposed to be walking their dogs. And again, the reason for that is because dog presence can scare bighorn sheep away from certain essential habitat areas. So this trails group had identified areas that dog use or dogs on trails is not appropriate for the recovery of bighorn sheep. And interestingly enough, we found out that Riverside County Animal Control or Animal Services had actually visited this trailhead a couple of times in April to educate dog users about not walking their dogs and on these trails, which was news to me. And it was really great news because I hadn't communicated directly with Riverside County Animal Services. They do contract their services to the city of Palm Desert. So their officer had shared with me, I spoke with him on the phone, and he told me that he had gone out a couple of times in April and that he saw, he didn't see any dog walkers though at the time. He theorizes it's probably getting a little too warm. So thankfully he hasn't seen any dog walkers, but we think that even just, you know, having a presence there is better than nothing. So we're hoping that, you know, I told him, you know, when it cools off again, if he could help us out again by doing the same thing, that would be great. And he was very friendly and very willing to help us out. Again, they have limited capacity, right? We have a lot of trails. We don't expect this to completely solve our problem, but we do hope that we can build a good relationship with Riverside County Animal Services.
And Tony, do they contract with Cathedral City as well, I believe?
I don't think so. They do. Okay.
Yeah, I recently called.
Oh, okay.
And, so it's possible we can get them up in the Cove area as well, maybe doing some patrols and some presence up there.
Yeah. Yeah, I stand corrected. He told me they don't contract with the city of Palm Springs.
Right.
And a couple others that I don't remember, but.
Yeah, Rancho Mirage has their own animal services.
Yeah, that's right. But Cathedral City, yeah, that could be great. That'd
be great.
Yeah. So it's just another tool that we could use here. Next, we wanted to talk about bicyclist outreach. I didn't know how much time we were going to have to talk about this, but I did ask Tom Cohn, who is our representative for the bicycling community, to share a little bit of information about the National Mountain Biking Association trail rating system, which Danny Ortiz had brought up last time. Tom, did you want to chime in a little bit, a quick summary of what you found out about the system?
Yeah, am I on speaker?
Yep, we can hear you.
Okay, great. Yeah, the International Mountain Biking Rating System really originates from the skiing system, where they identified trails by perceived strenuousness and complication, rideability and so on, and also by the width of the trail. And they have five levels, white, blue, green, black diamond, and double black diamond. The double black diamond would be equivalent to almost all of the off-road trails that are coming from like the double track trails off in the Indian Canyons and Palm Canyons area. Very few of our trails would actually be rated less than Black Diamond, simply because of the rocky terrain and the lack of long distance straight line rides. But that's something that's self-assigned, so that it's not that there's an organization that actually goes out for race trails, but rather the owner of the trail is responsible for identifying what the level is for each of the trails.
Yeah, so I wanted to bring this up because I think it could be a useful tool if we're trying to kind of consolidate bicyclist use by essentially marketing some trails as, you know, double black diamond versus black diamond or whatever. It could be an interesting idea if we wanted to look at that further. And if the committee was interested, I could reach out to the International Mountain Biking Association directly and see if they could present more about this system and what they've seen throughout the nation to this group at a future meeting. Any ideas or thoughts from the group?
I particularly don't have an issue with it, but let's make sure that we're rating trails, black diamond, blue, green, purple, whatever it is they're going to do that. You're rating trails in jurisdictions that allow biking.
Mm-hmm.
Don't rate my trails with these rankings if you know that biking is not allowed in Palm Springs. I don't want those rankings on the trails.
Right.
Because it puts out a false sense of, hey, you can ride here. It's a black diamond. No, it's not. It's not allowed.
Right.
So
right.
Let's make sure that if that happens, that it's in jurisdictions where it's allowed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you rank them illegal?
What's that?
Can you rank them illegal?
Yeah, is that a ranking on their national?
I didn't see it. But
or,
we could...
or the graffiti sign that was posted up in Palm Canyon, angry Indians ahead.
Yeah, that's not a ranking either. Rick, you bring up a great point. I think this from what I gathered as well, it would be up to the trail owner, essentially that landowner, to voluntarily rank their trail. So we couldn't go out and rank other people's trails in the city of Palm Springs, for example, or on the tribal lands. Now, I think that's something to be careful with, because if it's as simple as grabbing a black sticker and putting it on, you know, and then you just share that on social media. Now, hey, this is, that could be easily, you know, manipulated. So we would definitely need to learn more, find out how other areas have handled this and what issues they've run into. And if it seems like it'd be too much of a problem to manage, then maybe we just go with a different alternative, right? But it could be something worth exploring further.
Any other national monuments have this kind of ranking system?
I think they're pretty popular in Colorado. I haven't dug that deep into the research of this. I did ask Tom if he could look into it for me. I do know that Colorado, they're pretty well used, yeah.
Forest Service up in Big Bear uses this as well for mountain biking.
Okay.
The question I have is, Have we had any cyclists or hikers or anyone attempt to sue property owners for not having marked the trails or not having given information about the trails that would persuade a novice not to bike it or to hike it?
Can you repeat your question, Tom?
Have we had any experience with hikers or bikers or horse people suing a landowner for injury on their property?
Oh, I'm not aware of anything like that.
Okay, because it seems to me that more than anything, the trail rating system is more for the protection of the owner, so that the owner basically says, this is really strenuous, or this is really difficult, or this isn't a very well-maintained trail, so buyer beware.
Got it. Okay.
You know, Tony, I think it'd be worth pursuing contacting them to find out if this association would put trail restrictions into their database and their rating system,
mm-hmm.
So that they don't identify trails that you can't cycle on.
Right. Yeah. Is there a way that we can communicate not only which trails are harder than others, but which ones are absolutely no-go for bicycles?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another good thing to think about, too, with that, with bicycles is certain trails may cross over into places where bikes aren't allowed, either going through wilderness or tribal lands. So kind of noting ahead of time, if it's a partial thing, is that something do you really want to promote as mountain bike trail? You can only do a portion of it, not a full trail. So I think that'd be something important to consider.
And I think in our trail plan subcommittee, we talked about we need to take a look at the entire system.
Mm-hmm.
And see which trails we're misleading people, because we're going to say you can cycle on it on X property, but when you get to somebody, you know, the tribal property, you can't. And I think it's gotten more complicated, you know, in the past few years.
Right.
And we might have to look at some additional restrictions.
Yeah, treating the trail as a whole in where appropriate, right? There are going to be trails that go onto tribal land and private land and this and that, but are there some that can stay pretty much on one type of land, whether it be a combination of CVCC and state land or something like that from start to end? And then we could maybe look at rating that one way or treating it one way. When you look at the trails plan, you see how much of a trail is on different land owner types. And it gets really confusing. It's like 0.1 mile on tribal and then 0.5 miles on federal and then 0.6 on state. And it gets trying to manage that as one cohesive unit is really complicated. Okay, well, I'll reach out to them and see if we can learn more and kind of continue on that conversation. Last, I do have a couple of quick updates. The regional trail crew, CVCC did contract Urban Conservation Corps. We've been working with them for the past couple of years now. And over at Palm Hills, what's known as Palm Hills or Rimrock, one of the trails is called McManus. It's the one that goes by the Desert Water Agency water tanks. And there has been some erosion and some shortcuts being made. So in May, you can see here some before and after photos. They did go out and improve the trail, really stabilize it and make it clear as to where the trail should be and that shortcuts are not welcome. This is another before and after here, so you can kind of see some of the improvement there. And then here are some, these aren't before and after, but just some additional photos. So this is something that we're going to continue to do. This is on areas where we do have site control. So this isn't going to be the entire reserve system, but we do have this opportunity in areas where it is owned by CVCC. Thanks to Doug for sharing out that you've noticed some of these issues here. So if you haven't been out there, maybe wait till it cools off again, but you want to go check it out.
But we're going up this afternoon. Got to look at it. Can you talk to me so I can get home safe?
But put the Jeep in tow or the Rhino?
You probably need
both. On the helicopter.
Okay. And then last but not least, I just wanted to reiterate some funding opportunities that we have found. This one's from State Parks. I shared this with the group last time, but the deadline is in October. Well, we think it's going to be in October. This one's a maximum award of $150,000, and it can be used for repairing trails, developing facilities, and we could look into whether or not it could help with NEPA compliance. And then a second opportunity with the Land and Water Conservation Fund for up to $5 million. This one's due in August for some federal lands permitting, construction and renovating facilities, helping with trails, and even some support facilities. So this is something we want to continue to, you know, keep our eye on if we want to go after funding, or we want to look at other partnerships that we can establish to help with funding. But all of these different challenges and opportunities that we have all cost money. So going after funding to help with this is always always welcome. Any questions from the group? Any last comments? Yeah, Rich?
Is Chris's PowerPoint available for download, or from CVCC, or is there a website location?
Not available for download. It's with CVCC right now.
Yeah, so you can't share it, right?
Like, that stuff is what I'm putting in a report to the public.
Okay.
So not yet.
I did have a question.
Yeah.
Probably more for Chris, but you mentioned the areas where they're building areas for water for the bighorn sheep, and you call them a drink. Did you call
it drinker? Guzzler.
Guzzler. I noticed that out in Mecca along the canals, there are certain places along the canal where they have them. I'm also the land development engineer for the city. And yeah. So when developers come into town, we have, and Doug knows this, they have the ability to have public benefit items that they can give back, right? As part of their development, they have upgraded solar, upgrade a new playground, plant new trees at somewhere else. So they have all these public benefit things that they can do. And I'm just wondering if those types of items could be added to a public benefit to add a drinker or something like that as part of their mitigation.
Okay.
In those bighorn overlay areas that the models, one of the, you know, pick a model and see if they can put one in. Would that be something that they could do as a developer, or would it be more to give money to the agency that would build a drinker, or can that developer be obligated to do something like that?
On principle, that sounds awesome. Legally, I think we have to look, I would have to ask our lawyers or something about it. If it's like its own thing, hey, we've identified a need for a drinker.
Or if you guys identify them, or
yeah,
the organization identifies them, they go, okay, we're going to build it. You tell us where to build it.
Yeah, then I think, I mean, that's no problem. That's something that I would, you know, be in favor for. But if it's something to do as like a mitigation effort, like in order for a development to go in place, they have to provide something there. That's something that I think is a little bit out of my scope at the moment.
They already have to pay the fee. They have to pay the MS. What's the acronym for it?
Yeah, the CBMSHCP.
They have to pay that fee, right? So maybe the part of that fee is also add to the drinker.
I think it's something we can discuss for sure. I would have to defer to, you know, the architects of the MSHCP or.
We can look into it more. I think, I know from our standpoint, CVCC, even though we, you know, we're the implementers of the CBMSHCP, we actually don't have a permit to put in an artificial drinker either.
Yeah.
And that's because it's considered harassment of the sheep.
Correct.
And we don't have that ability. So
that part I get, but I also hear that, you know, nobody has any money to build these things. Well, somebody else is flipping the bill.
Right. Yeah, we can look into that more. What we did was we essentially asked the Tom. There we go. Never mind. So we had the wildlife agencies bill the drinker. That could be, maybe there's a way to kind of work that out between the overall CBMSCCP, developers and mitigation, and the wildlife agencies. We can definitely look into that more.
Wildlife agencies say, hey, it costs this much to build a drinker. All right. My home builder is now going to pay for that one. Anyway.
Right, yeah.
We have to come down to sort of like an equivalent exchange. For example, development out of Coachella, the city of Coachella wants to have happen. So we've been working with this developer for over a year for them to come to fruition. And in order to get their development done, they needed to take out some honey mesquite to get the road to pass through. So basically the land that they wanted to give us wouldn't have been a like exchange. It wasn't going to be a one for one, even though they were giving us more land than they were taking. It just wasn't suitable habitat for mesquite to grow. So they had to go out and find some. And that's all still in the works. So nothing's written in pen, to my knowledge, and it's definitely out of my scope of responsibility for authorizing, but it is something that we pay attention to. So a guzzler sounds, like let's just go ahead and get a bank of these, and then all of a sudden they're paid for. Like I said, we don't have the ability, and it might not equate to the kind of take that they're taking.
Yeah. So the reason I bring it up is I tell all of my land developers in town, all the easy land to develop has already been developed. So now you're in the rock gardens, you're in the wind zones, you're in the places nobody wants to build houses, but you're also closer to the models for the Bighorn Sheep. You're also closer to these other resources that are supposed to be protected. As part of that encroachment, I can simply add that as a public benefit item. I don't mind making developers pay for these things, right? They want to build, they're going to pay the admission price. But it'd be nice if it was modeled out to say, hey,
there's some options.
Here it is. You know.
Very, very interesting.
Yeah, we'll look into it and then provide an update at the next meeting. Any other closing remarks or items?
I have a correction, kind of. Earlier you asked about if mycoplasma was spread, you know, with horses. I've since talked to the vets or a vet. That would be an unusual route for mycoplasma. It's particularly spread through goats, sheep, deer, reindeer.
Oh, deer. Oh, okay.
But like once again, for the spread of the Joshua Tree strand, mycoplasma to come over to the peninsula range. It could be these weird events that have just occurred, or it's something that we're probably never going to know how it got here, just that it is here at the trap.
Mm. Their deer is interesting because your muleys probably go back and forth.
Who knows? Mm. Yeah.
If you've got bears going across I-10 and the San Gregorio Pass, you have deer.
Yeah. And then, reindeer come every Christmas, right? So
probably not that enough.
And then we have a question or comment from the public.
In your the trails plan work group, you mentioned e-bikes. I was just wondering if you could expand on that, how you're going to address that going forward.
Yeah, that is it's essentially just an item that this group is going to work through. E-bikes were discussed a lot last year because in some legal frameworks, they see them as motorized vehicles. In some, they see them as, other mobilized devices. And so there's a lot to discuss with e-bikes. I don't think that anyone has a clear answer one way or the other of what's going to happen in the future with e-bikes. But currently we know that in the city of Palm Springs, there's an ordinance against anything motorized, anything that's not powered by your own, by a person. And so for us, for CBCC, we manage the trailhead. We own the trailhead at Rimrock. And so we have a sign that no e-bikes are allowed at that trailhead because it's within the city of Palm Springs. And then at the time, I think BLM didn't permit them on footpaths, right?
So for BLM, our policy is e-bikes are not allowed until we make an official rule for that through our land use plan. But we do have, for people that may need it, a reasonable accommodation request that you can put in for on our website. So if you just punch in BLM and e-bikes, it'd go to our field manager to review that accommodation. And then if approved, you'd have a letter just for riding an e-bike on BLM lands. We're not approving anything outside of that scope, but that would be something if needed, we do have available, but otherwise we discourage e-bikes.
And I think that's something where we all need to be on the same page, right? Because if you're allowed to use it on BLM land, but not on others, then that gets into this issue that we have with all of our trail management, which is just confusing rules and a lot of different land types that people may or may not pay attention to.
And then just to add in, on Agua Caliente land, no bikes are permitted.
Right, not even mountain bikes.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And I'll add to that too. So some cities, like we're in the middle of doing our general plan update. Mm-hmm. So general plan update just was completed, now they do the zone. So by time that anybody wanted to go to those meetings and say, hey, we think you should change this ordinance, hey, we think that you should change this muni code, you know, that's been going on for, how long does a general plan update take? 3 years? Whatever it takes.
Depends.
I mean, Doug did this for 2 years. It takes a long
time. 2 to 5 years to never.
Yeah. And ours took a while. And so all those public hearings, all of those very public hearings, public outreaches, all this kind of stuff of how you want this updated, not this updated, that's old language, this is new language. That was our city has recently just completed. And then now they're doing the zoning update right now, which will take probably the rest of the year, I think, is where it's going. But that has nothing to do with the trails. So that portion of it for any updates is already done with us.
Okay.
For this new latest update. And okay. The general plan updates are every, how many years, Doug? 12 years, 10 years, 8 years?
Well, I don't recall what the criteria is. Most cities do it whenever they can afford it.
Yeah. So they can afford it like every 12 years, I think. Because it's expensive. It's not a cheap thing.
You're required to do within like every 5 years to do a general update, but that could be nothing more than a report that says we're not going to do anything. Oftentimes the updates are driven by changes in state law, and that usually affects the housing element first and foremost.
Yeah.
You know, they change something from the state perspective that affects local.
Yeah, we had a lot of changes from ACD, which drove as a mechanism for all that. We finished all that, wrapped all that up beginning about 2 months ago, 3 months ago.
So what I'm hearing is that the current state in Palm Springs with the ordinance is sticking around.
The way it is written right now is the way it's going to be for a while. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't petition city council to do something, but you can only do so many general plan updates in a year or a five-year period, right, by law. Okay. So being that they just finished the update, chances of them changing anything are pretty slim.
So, okay, that's helpful to know. Okay, all right. Well, I think we're adjourned. Thank you, everybody. And next meeting will be September 17th at 1:30, and it'll be the new location.